Hi, everybody. It's David Wood. Welcome back to Wood on Words, the podcast for all things writing and publishing. This is episode 42. Pretty much the same old going on with my writing lately. I'm working on the same projects that I've been working on. The one new thing is a new Kindle World story written by me and Terry Irvin called Cavern. Just came out yesterday. And going to be promoting that later this week. So that is the one bit of new information. Otherwise, I'm just working on the same old stuff, still moving forward. A few things happening in the publishing world, though, that I think are worth mentioning. First of all, a couple of days ago, it might have been Monday, I don't recall, we found out that Pronoun is closing. If you're not familiar, Pronoun, like Draft to Digital, is... soon it'll be was, but right now they still exist, is a company that would publish your book out to all the various vendors. So if you were a person who liked to be able to just upload your one document and have that convenience, that was one of your possible resources for publication. And one of the interesting things with Pronoun was that it, unlike some of the others, could also publish to Kindle. Now, what that meant was you couldn't use things like AMS ads, and your books could not be in the Kindle Unlimited program for borrows and stuff like that. But what Pronoun did that was actually better than going with Kindle is that you got a higher royalty rate on books below the $2.99 price and above the $9.99 price. For people who weren't around at the very beginning of Kindle, when Kindle started out, the royalty rate was 35%, and that was just it, regardless of where you priced your book. After a while, I don't remember how long it was, maybe a year, but after Amazon had aggregated and compiled enough sales data to really take a look, they concluded that the sales sweet spot, depending on the length of your book and your genre and all that, was between $2.99 and $9.99. And so in order to incentivize that, they... made the royalty for that price point 70%. Of course, along with that came their price matching policy, that if you had the book priced lower on any other vendor, they would drop it down and match that price. So a lot of people misunderstand, and they think that the 35% royalty that Kindle pays on books priced below $2.99 or over $9.99 is somehow a penalty, when it's actually the reverse. 35% is your standard, and the 70% royalty rate for that $2.99 to $9.99 sweet spot is actually a reward for pricing within the range where Amazon's data tells them that your books are most likely to sell. So with Pronoun, you got that 70% in the sweet spot, but you also got it for the lower price and the higher price. So that was kind of cool, especially if you were doing, say, a 99-cent book bundle, you would basically double your money on those sales. The other thing that they did that was better than Kindle, for some people, is that you could set up a pre-order up to a year in advance. Now, what that did for some people, it was really used a lot by these box set stuffers that we've talked about, who use their combination of legitimate and sketchy strategies to hit the USA Today bestseller list. When you set up a pre-order, you are accruing sales throughout that pre-order period, and you can see on your dashboard how many sales you've made. But those sales are not credited to your account until release day, and they are all reported to places like USA Today as if they have been made on, it's either on release day or on the first 2 days or something like that, or maybe the day before and the day of. I kind of remember there's a wrinkle to it, but basically, if you have a one-year pre-order and you accumulate enough pre-orders, you're going to get credit for a ton of sales right there at the beginning. And you line up your release so it falls into USA Today's reporting period. And so, you know, you get this big boost and it improves your chances of hitting the list. So a lot of these box set scammers were using Pronoun, putting a massive box set together and publishing it without assets, because really they're often offering more books that can actually fit in a box set, and they shuffle them around. But I digress. Anyway, they would set up this massive box set, set it at 99 cents, and put it up for sale for a year and encourage all the people within the set to promote that pre-order for as much as they could. gave them a lengthy time on the hot new release list and things like that, if they made it, then it would accumulate all those sales. The sales would drop at the beginning of the US 80 reporting period, and then they would do their other things, like they were having their members buy the book, buy copies of it on every vendor, and then trading future promotional credits for it. And then some legit things like advertising, Facebook ads, things like that. So anyway, Pronoun was popular amongst the box set scammers. Also, one scammer whom we've discussed who has lost her KDP account, she was either publishing through Pronoun or publishing through proxies via Pronoun. I guess she's going to have to find a proxy to publish her somewhere else now. So anyway, Pronoun finally announced that they're going to be shutting their doors. So that's the end of that one. And I'm not really sure what to think about it. They started as a different company. They might have had a couple incarnations. At one point, they were called Vook, V-O-O-K. And I think they had this weird model where they were paying 100% royalties, so I don't know how they were making any money. But Macmillan, the Big Five publishing company, bought them and ran them for a while. And I don't really know what their strategy was. Maybe they thought it was going to be more profitable. Maybe they believed that they could put a dent in Kindle and KDP by offering slightly better terms. But for whatever reason, they've now decided to abandon the Pronoun publishing platform. And things are going on with Macmillan. They've got a really well-known headquarters in the Flatiron Building in New York City. They're abandoning that. I've heard that they've had layoffs and things. Traditional publishing, you know, still struggles in a lot of ways, and apparently Macmillan is too. So anyway, goodbye to Pronoun. And then after that announcement was made, the very next day, Draft Digital announced that they will start distributing to Kindle. That is a new development for Draft Digital. You couldn't do that. They had distribution to pretty much everybody else, but not to Kindle. Now, here's the thing with Draft Digital. On the one hand, they're easy to use. There's a lot to like about their company. But in order to make money, they're going to take a small percentage of your sales from these other vendors. So if you'll get a few pennies more per book if you publish directly, say, to Kobo Writing Life and directly to Nook than if you go to them through Draft Digital. So it's really a question of how much lost revenue you're talking about and whether that balances out with the convenience. And for me, because non-Kindle stores are comparatively, they sell so few copies, it's worth the couple of pennies that I sacrifice in order to have that convenience of having Draft Digital distribute directly to all these vendors. Kindle, however, is going to be a different story for me. Now, with Draft Digital, same deal. You're going to lose basically roughly 5 cents per unit. They're estimating that below the $2.99 cost, they're going to give you approximately 30%, which going direct to Kindle will give you 35. And in the $2.99 to $9.99 range, they're estimating 60 to 65%, whereas Kindle is going to be 70 minus a fee for the based on the size of the file. So, you know, maybe you don't have a lot of sales yet, or maybe you have a ton of sales and you don't care, but you know, you are going to be sacrificing a little money by going to Kindle. And for me, I move so many units on Kindle, not only of my own stuff, that's also by far the best-selling store for other Griffinwood authors, that that 5 cents per copy is worthwhile to me. Maybe that will change someday. I kind of hope not. But anyway, that's going to be a consideration for you if you think about using Draft Digital to also go to Kindle. And again, unlike Pronoun, Draft Digital is conforming with Kindle's royalty structure where you're going to get that slashed in half royalty at price points below $2.99 and above $9.99, plus Draft Digital taking their own cut. And of course, just like with Pronoun, if you publish to Kindle through Draft Digital, you will not be able to use Kindle Unlimited and things like that, or be part of KDP Select. I don't know what their rules are going to be for pre-orders. I should have double-checked before I did this episode, but I just now thought of it. I do believe that you can do longer pre-order periods through some of the other vendors when you're publishing through Draft Digital, so it might be that you can get a longer pre-order on Kindle, which, you know, sometimes that's worthwhile. If you can sell enough to hit the hot new releases list and stay there, it might get you more visibility. So that's going to be something I will research and get back to everybody on. But those are two of the bigger happenings in the publishing world the last couple days. And so now we are going to move along to an interview. Our guest this week is Paul E. Cooley. Paul is Paul has been in the indie game a long time, both publishing his own stuff and being published in indie presses. He's enjoyed some success in the darker side of fiction. And also, Paul was one of that first wave of podcasting his fiction, and he continues to do that and do really well, while at the same time doing really well in audiobooks with the same stuff. So he's got an interesting perspective, and I think you will really enjoy him. So here's Paul. We are here with author Paul E. Cooley. Paul, welcome to Wood on Words.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
Well, I would say that I'm glad for you to be here, but you'd know I was lying.
Yeah, I know it was all lies and propaganda.
For those of us, for those listeners who are not familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Who I am, what I do. I am Paul E. Cooley. I'm a writer of horror, sci-fi, techno thrillers, deep space marine kind of stuff. I like to write about gods that may exist, may not exist, and urban fantasy. And once upon a time, I also wrote about Muppets, but I'm not allowed to do that anymore.
So you're really good at picking a lane is what you're telling us.
Oh yeah, I'm great at swerving through lanes. I like to make my way from one side of the traffic cones to the other. You know, basically start in the left hand lane, go all the way across six lanes of traffic to the right. Hopefully, not kill anybody in the process, and then decide that no, I want to go back to the left. So, yeah. Any genre is fair game.
You are both you're an indie published author. You're also traditionally published through indie presses. And so kind of just start at the beginning and take us through your journey to where you find yourself today.
Wow. Autobiography time. Haven't done this in a while. About 10 years ago, yeah, it's been a decade and it's really terrifying. I started podcasting my stories for free at shadowpublications.com and I got a following with a few short stories and unofficially called the Fiends Collection, which was stories about serial killers. And that grew into a little book called Tattoo. It's a novella that kind of broke things out and got me an audience, so to speak. And then after that, I started writing much longer works and pretty much didn't get a large pay audience until a couple of years ago, where I wrote a book called The Black, which is basically a mashup of The Blob meets The Thing meets Alien, set on an exploration oil rig thousands of miles away from land. And it's been pretty popular, and that's pretty much what got me a contract with Sever Press, who I'm still publishing with, another series with them as well called Derelict, which takes place in the far future. And that's pretty much where things stand now. But I've written Closet Treats, which is a horror book that's in somebody's book bundle out there right now.
We're going to get to that. Yep.
Can't imagine who that would be. And also the Garagas Children stuff, which is basically stories that take place in prehistory and up through the burning of the first library of the first burning of the Library of Alexandria in 48 BCE. So I'm kind of all over the place with that. With that stuff, Garaga is very popular with those people who have actually read it. But The Black and Derelict are the two series that are making me cash right now.
Tell us a little bit more about the Derelict series.
Derelict is a Space Marines series and not a Space Marine series. It's basically humanity sends a ship off to go look for resources. It disappears 7 years into its mission. 43 years later, it comes stumbling back into the Kuiper Belt without any power or communication abilities, just the catastrophe beacon going off. And so they send a group of Marines out there to a search and rescue ship to go out there and take a look and try and bring it back to Neptune, where the actual Marine base is. And hilarity ensues because of a AI conspiracy coupled with them not understanding what exactly came back with it. So it's kind of fun. It's got horror. It's got suspense. It's got the little military bits of Marines fighting off aliens and all sorts of other good stuff in there. So I'll be wrapping that up, or I'm wrapping that book up right now, or that series up right now with the third book. So, but there'll be others in that universe.
Yeah. Would it be fair to compare it to the movie Aliens, perhaps? That it's sort of sci-fi in that way?
Yes and no. I'm not really sure what a good analog to it is. It doesn't have that same kind of we're going to fight them, you know, on the ground kind of thing with a bunch of weapons. It doesn't quite work that way. It's basically what I'm talking about, and I love to do this, is mash things up. It is both Derelict and the Black are built on one premise to a certain extent, which is, what if our science is wrong? Or what if our science only applies in certain cases, and that there are things out there that do not make any sense by our understanding of physical laws and behavior? So it gives kind of a new threat and a new obstacle to deal with when humans try and, you know, basically put together the reasons why something is not acting the way it should. And of course, it's all stolen from the idea that there are the common elements, for instance, hydrogen, oxygen, may have isotopes that at certain atomic levels become insanely, insanely stable. But because they are so massive, they begin to exhibit different attributes and allow certain things to happen. So it's Derelict is basically taking Space Marines and throwing them in a situation where, you know, a lot of things just do not make sense. And they have to find a way to survive and you know, get away from it.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things I wanted to ask you about on this show, we've talked with a lot of authors about the importance of identifying, first of all, what other successful indie authors are doing to hook readers, or in your case, readers or listeners, because you podcast, but also to be able to identify it in our own writing. And it sounds like the two hooks that keep readers coming back to your most popular series are that idea of what if science doesn't tell us everything or is wrong, and the whole mashup concept. Would you think that that's a fair assessment of what ties your best stuff together?
I think it didn't start out as a conscious decision. It just kind of ended up that way. But I think that is one of the things that people really enjoy about my work, is I like to weird reality. And I like to question it on a lot of cases, and whether that's because of a person's mental illness suffering from psychosis, or it's, hey, you know, this little object we found out there, it was 2,000 light years away. Well, it ain't what we thought it was. It's a lot of fun to play in that space. Of course, you have to make interesting characters, and the story has to be interesting as well. But I think that, yeah, one of the appeals is that I'm writing hard sci-fi, but it's also got this element of things that don't match our expectations or that violate laws as we understand them. Because I think it's just a lot of fun to do that. You know, what if the physics didn't work? What if there are non-carbon based life forms out there? How would they act? What traits would they have? What if they could actually live in space and not even have to be on a planet? What kind of creatures would they be? So there's a lot of fun in that. I also like to deal a lot with humanity's evolution as well, social evolution, scientific evolution, and you know, where I kind of see us headed. And with Derelict anyway, that's been, you know, that's been one of the loves of the series, at least from what I've heard of the readers. They really enjoy the vision that I have for the future. As disturbing as they may be in some cases. But, you know, the idea that we don't know everything. We seem to be this very arrogant species now that seems to, oh, we've got everything figured out. Everything's carbon and oxygen. Well, we don't really know that for sure. Everything that we can prove says that, but we haven't really searched much. We actually know more about space than we do the deep ocean at this point, which is absolutely terrifying to me. And that's one of the reasons why The Black has been so much fun to write. because you can actually go out there and study all the things. And every day we're making these new discoveries about space. We're making these new discoveries about what's deep beneath the ocean. And then those things all just kind of roll into plot ideas. And then the characters show up and they do what they do. So it's fun.
And mayhem typically ensues.
Oh yeah, hilarity always ensues. There's always going to be Terry Mixon likes to quote Jim Butcher about the fact that you can either have your characters lose, you can either have them win, or you can have them win, but in the process of that win, they make things worse. And I really love that third one.
Absolutely. Now, when you get feedback from readers, what do they like the most, and what upsets them the most about your work? What gets you the extremes?
Two sides of the same coin. There are the folks that don't like my idea of what the military becomes after social evolution, in the sense that gender has a lot less to play. Sexual attitudes are very different. The, casual use of marijuana, THC, for instance, is abhorrent to them, but I use it, in the stories. And at the same time, the flip side, which is showing growth of humanity to basically say, we don't need to have these boundaries anymore because they're ephemeral. They don't matter. And it's very funny how you can include something, seemingly innocuous, which is, a gay character or something like that, and have people completely flip out. Or there are other people who can basically say, call me a right-wing zealot because of something I've put in a book, which is about as far away from the truth as you can get. So, I mean, you never really know what's going to trigger somebody, and you just have to learn to stop worrying about it, because you're going to piss off somebody no matter what you do. It's just a fact of life. But it is funny how often I'll see a review saying, hey, I love this. And then you'll see a review from somebody else saying, I hated this. And they'll both be talking about the same thing. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting what people will project into your writing. Like you said, things that they think they're identifying that really are not at all accurate to what you're trying to do or what you're trying to say. So do you ever intentionally choose something that will get a reaction out of somebody?
That reaction? No, I wrote one book that way. I wrote The Street that way. Nothing else has been intentional. I will occasionally throw the social commentary barb in there. With Gare's Inferno, for instance, which is a book hopefully will be out later this month, takes place in modern day, no space or monsters running around. But there are certain moments where I'm talking about, gentrification. I'm talking about problems with that we bump up against about history, what portions of history we want to forget, what portions of history we want to remember. And discuss, the civil rights movement and other things that are going on there. And just simple, plain old, wow, that person's ugly looking, so they must be a horrible human being or somebody you want to associate with, or you can't see them as a person because of their scars. And I love playing in those spaces too, because they're a lot of fun to explore, because I think it's really interesting to look at how I think in those ways, and also how, society thinks in those ways. And I think it is kind of fun and important for writers to kind of explore those areas.
Now, you mentioned the book bundle. I talked about it last week as well, but we've got a 10-novel collection out called 10 Open Graves. And the book that you have that kicks off the collection is called Closet Treats. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Okay, Closet Treats is basically, the main character has psychosis, and which is not the same thing as psychopathic. He's psychotic in the sense that he has delusions. He knows he has delusions. He sees an ice cream truck one day in the neighborhood, and he doesn't see a human being driving it. He sees a demon driving it. And so the rest of the book is basically him trying to come to grips with whether or not this is really happening or if it's just another delusion. And of course, hilarity ensues, as it always does.
So some people are afraid of clowns. You're getting people afraid of the ice cream man.
Yeah. So what? Interesting side note. After I wrote that book, we published it in, I think, May, and I can't remember what year that was. And then that summer in Houston, we had 5 ice cream trucks shot at or drivers killed. It was creepy. It was really creepy, to say the least. So, there's just something about it. And it all came from I was sitting in my office working on a book, and I heard the ice cream truck music blaring. You know, do your ears hang low? Did they wobble to and fro? And it was at volume 11. So I went out on the front deck to see what the hell this thing was. And sure enough, it was like a Ford Econoline van that had been converted and, had the typical ice cream truck kind of decals and everything else on the sides of it. But what creeped me out were the windows were tinted. And that really freaked me out. So I went back and I wrote an essay. I podcasted it. People were freaking out over that, going, when are you writing this book? When are you writing this book? Because I was talking about, for all I know, there was a demon driving this stupid thing. And I fought against the idea of writing the book for the longest time. And then finally I said, screw it. And I wrote it.
How do you balance the things that you're writing that you know are going to be your most commercially viable with the things that you write just because people are pestering you to write it because it's a cool idea or because your subconscious wants you to write it? How do you make those decisions?
Lately, it's been just trying to get the work out that's making the money right now. And I'm finally at a point where, like, for instance, I can polish off the Derelict Saga, and that'll be 3 books in 1 year, essentially. And a complete story of 300,000 words. So basically it's one story told in 3 different books. But the good thing is getting that done is going to afford me the liberty to go work on a couple of other things that I want to work on. It's all about trying to figure out where the sweet spot is. I think at this point I want to do 2 commercial projects and then do, 1 for love every year. 2 to 3 commercial projects, 1 for love, make sure it, even if it doesn't sell, that I'll be okay. And I have a little more freedom of that right now because I have a part-time gig that doesn't steal too much of my time, but does make a little money. So I've got a better cushion than I used to have. But it's tough. I mean, you have these ideas and, there are people out there dying for more stuff in the Garaga mythos, but it just didn't sell. So I really want to write more of those stories, but I have to kind of put them off and choose a time to do it when it's, convenient for my career. But I will get back to them. It's on my list of things for next year is actually writing the first commercially viable Garaga story. So maybe I can pair the 2 things and, everybody will be happy.
So what's your favorite subgenre to write in?
I don't think I have one. this is where I'm really torn. People ask me about this. I love science. I love history. And I love dealing with things that are kind of scary. And I just try and find ways to marry those 3 things together. And that's pretty much what I write. And I've joked that I'm going to write a romance at some point. That's really not a joke. I will do it, but it will have my typical stamp on it somewhere, which is going to be disturbing in some ways.
And there will be tentacles.
And there will not be tentacles in that one. No, no tentacles in that one. there's just the genre myth is so pervasive at this point. And it's like horror is not a genre. Horror is a feeling. It is the spice. It is what you marinate the story in. It can have central elements. The tale can have central elements of horror, but there is no such thing as a horror story. If you go back and look at the original horror stories, like Edgar Allan Poe, et cetera, you're going to find that they're more or less detective stories. Even the stuff that Lovecraft wrote, quite a few of them are told in that manner. The horror parts were just different pieces that were put in there to make the characters, jump, and then by connection make the reader jump. So I love putting horror in my books. I love suspense stories. And I just try and find ways to write those tales in interesting new settings or with new elements. So I love all genres. I'm also going to write a horror Western. It's going to happen.
Yeah. I want to write a fantasy Western, but you know, there's the same kind of overlap over there. You know, horror can lap into fantasy, or it has the fantastic in it quite often. Thinking back to the beginning of your publishing career, why indie over Big Five?
It started out as I stopped writing when I was 24 because of a major altercation I had with an agent. I thought everything was cool and on the up and up, and they try to screw me. And in the process, I got so disgusted with the entire idea of publishing that I went into software. I just abandoned writing and said, you know what? I've been doing this for, 10 years and I'm smashing my head into the wall. It's just not worth it anymore. Why should I spend my time doing this? So I stopped doing it. And it wasn't until, I wrote occasionally, but nothing of substance for a while. And then when I got back into the game, I got back into the game after paying attention to podcasters like Scott Sigler, who built their career on podcasting. Their books. And my wife was like, why aren't you going to start? What is it going to take for you to start doing this so you can start writing again? So I started the podcast. And at that point, I was pretty damn militant because my friends or my colleagues that I'd met through the podcasting sphere that did have Big Five contracts suffered some horrible indignities while they were on their way. And it just reinforced the idea that the gatekeepers were completely insane and just out to basically make as much money off us as possible. And so I was like, you know what? Screw this. If I'm writing stuff that they don't want to publish, then I'll do it myself. I'll do all the things a publisher does. I'll pay for pro editing. I'll pay for pro book cover art, pro layout, the whole nine yards. And we'll put it out there and see if I can learn how to market it and make it sell. And it didn't sell. So I ultimately went with Severed Press because my buddy Jake Bible was in there and has had great success with Severed. And so I pitched them on a story idea and they liked it. So I said, screw it. I looked at the terms of the contract and went, wow, this is about as far away from the Big Five as you can get. And that made me happy. So I was willing to work with a small press. And I think the small presses are really what's keeping the genres or the experimental stories and the stories are kind of off the beaten path. I think they're the ones keeping them alive. And they're doing good work. They know what they're doing. They know how to market and it works out really well. So I'm a hybrid. I still want to do my indie stuff because I just do not want to give away any of the rights to some of my creations. So I'm always going to be doing both, I think.
So elaborate a little more on why you like to stay with Severed Press for at least a portion of your catalog. Can you give us, if someone were making that business decision, what did you think about in making that choice and what keeps you there for part of your catalog?
They don't fight me for audio rights, which is very lucrative for me because I narrate the audiobooks, put them out there, and I make a decent amount of money on Audible every year. So that was important. That's usually something you have to give up. Also, the royalty sharing agreements were very, very good. So, it's a big difference when you're talking about getting, 12 or 15% off an ebook and getting two or three times that with a small press, because if they know what they're doing, everybody makes money. And the other thing is the terms of rights, what I was able to do with my work versus what they were able to do with my work, all those things worked in my favor the way I saw it. And that was the big reason that I decided to go ahead and jump in and see if that will work for me. And it has.
Yeah, let's talk for a minute about contracts. I'm not going to ask you to disclose your terms, but I just want to say, since we do talk a lot of business on this podcast, if you're considering a small press, you should not be getting Big Five royalty terms. You should be getting 40% or more for your various things. There should be a specific ending date. You should not be surrendering lifetime rights. And like Paul said with audio, you should not be surrendering any rights that they are not already exploiting with their other authors, or don't have immediate systems in place. Don't sell your audio rights to a company that has no audiobooks yet. Don't sell your movie rights to a company that doesn't have a branch that's selling movie rights. So you should expect something very different from an indie press contract.
I think the biggest advice is or the watchwords from Dan Sawyer pretty much make it happen, or that's what I try and live by, which is everything is for sale, but don't sell yourself cheap. So, for instance, if a press wants my audiobook rights, they're going to have to pay a substantial advance. I mean substantial, because I'm looking at what an audiobook makes over its lifetime of 6 years, and that's a lot of money. It really is. At least in my situation, it is. So, you know, once you start looking at how much audiobooks can make and putting your stuff on YouTube if you're really popular or wherever, the bottom line is that is money that those are rights that they should have to pay for, because those are rights that you personally could be using to make money.
Yeah, we had Brian Anderson on the show a few weeks ago who's just – I mean, his big bread and butter now is bidding wars for his new audio rights, because he's just been very fortunate to get to that point. But even for those of us who are just doing, you know, well enough to be quite happy in audio, more and more places like Audible are seeking you out and making offers. Don't be so flattered by their offer that you don't do the math first, because like Paul said, it is possible that over a certain number of years you could make more money doing your own thing. But it's becoming more and more common for indies to get those kind of offers. From several audio studios. Audible isn't even the only game in town.
No, there are tons of them now. They're basically clearing houses for all intents and purposes.
Now, what does Severed do for you? You like the contract terms for a lot of reasons. What do you feel like they do well for you in terms of your individual books and for your overall catalog?
They have done a really, really good job of knowing the market that they're writing to, or that you know they're publishing to. Gary knows exactly how to couch a book so that it gets in front of people's faces. He does the promotional stuff that you absolutely positively need, which is somebody who's going to get you into BookBubs, things like that. He knows when it's time to pump a book's price. He knows when to deflate a book's price. But I think one of the things that I've really discovered about Severed over the years is there are people who will buy a Severed book because it is a Severed book. Because depending on what subgenre that he's marketing it as, they know what kind of story it's going to have. They know what kind of feel it's going to have. They know the stakes are going to be really big. They know that it's going to be a fun, action-packed ride. That may
now,
leave
am I
them,
correct
you know,
that they only do
terrified.
Like three very specific subgenres or something like that? That they're very.
It
tightly
used
focused.
To be that way. When I got in, the deep sea monster stuff was really in high gear, and that's one of the reasons why I pitched for the Black one so well. And they were really publishing zombie stuff and End of the World as We Know It, and then the sea monster stuff. Since then, he has branched out a lot. So, I mean, they're publishing, you know, fantasy. They're publishing hard sci-fi. They're publishing, you know, space marine stuff. They're all over the map now.
But they.
But it looks to me like he's doing it right. He does his research.
Okay.
So that's pretty much how they got going. Is basically they chose what they were going to focus on. And now he's successful enough that he's basically just broadening that because there's more people on board to help him make it happen.
And so that's kind of a lesson we can learn, even if we're not going with an indie press, is that in our own careers, we can think about that branding and pick a lane or two and try to cultivate the audience. That's a very valid strategy. And then others try to cast wide and build a very eclectic audience. But yeah, it's possible we can learn from something like that. Now, as you continue writing, have you considered, say, starting a series with Severed and then branching off either by continuing that series on your own or maybe connected part of that universe? Have you tried yet to take your Severed success and move it more directly into your indie stuff?
That is on the boards. I created the Soul and Beyond universe, and some of those books, Derelict was pretty much the kickoff for that particular universe. And there's going to be a lot more books in that space. Severed is not going to get a crack at all of them. There are probably at least three stories I can think of off the top of my head that I have on my planning boards that are going to be put out by me. And the reason is because I want to have complete control over that, and I want to succeed or fail on my own with those particular tales.
Let's circle back around to podcasting and podcasting your audio fiction, something that you mentioned. Now, there was a time when that was very new and very big, guys like you mentioned Scott Sigler, but if I remember correctly, it was pre-Kindle, so podcasting fiction was one of the ways indies, to me, could become rock stars back then, more so than through selling an ebook or a paperback.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Well, I was hoping you'd elaborate so it wouldn't be so boring, but I kind of didn't give you anything to say.
A follow-up.
No, I'm just talking out of my ass like usual. Well, anyway, back early, that was a good way for indies to get noticed because there weren't as many doing it, and it was almost like a golden age. Talk about your entry into podcasting fiction. Why did you do it? How did you do it? All that stuff.
Ooh, why? Because I basically figured out that this might be the last chance to, find a way to get the writing out there, get people in front of it, get some comments, get some feedback so I can, basically grow as a creator. And I spent, I guess when I started the podcast, I spent 6 months without doing any promotion for it. So I had like 25 listeners maybe. And I spent 6 months doing that. So I learned editing. I learned how to narrate my books. I improved with everything that I did. And after 6 months, I decided, okay, this is something I want to do. This is something I can do. And I think I can get good at it. And then I basically went all in, relaunched the podcast, did all the promotional stuff, and recycled what I'd already podcast before I launched. And basically, by relaunching it, it was a brand new podcast. And by virtue of the connections I've made through the community at that point, via Twitter, back when Twitter was not the seventh level of hell like it is now, we were doing all this cross promotion with different folks. We're sending out promos, and you had all these different shows going on at the same time. You had Sigler, JC Hutchins, you had, Philippa Ballantyne, T. Morris, you had Phil Rossi, you had just all these people doing all this crazy stuff. And then a group of five or six of us kind of gelled together, and we were all cross promoting, and all of us kind of took off about the same time. So it just reinforced the fact that we were still going to do this. And we constantly kicked each other in the shins on Twitter. And in our podcasts, we got our audiences warring with one another, which was hilarious because they were basically the same audience. There were all these little things that we did that made it just fun, for everybody involved. And it just made you want to do the work. It made you want to write. It made you want to get better at audio editing. It made you want to get better at putting out an episode every week. It just basically reinforced itself over and over again, and it just became fun.
It seems to me like it's not very common anymore. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it died off. It died off pretty big. I think I really can't even point to a specific instance when it just kind of died. I think there were several folks that thought they were going to get big five contracts like Ziggler did. Some of those luminaries, I could go into billions and billions of reasons why that didn't happen for these other folks. I can also give you billions and billions of reasons why it was never going to happen with those folks. But the bottom line was, is that people started realizing that those contracts were not going to be forthcoming, that he was an anomaly. And I think it took the wind out of the sails. Some of those folks ended up going off and doing small press stuff and have been very, very successful. Jake Bible being one of them. And, Pip and T are doing their thing, and they've had a pretty successful run with their series they did through tour. And of course, Nathan Lowell, you know, his stuff has been bought so many times, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, and now he's actually these audios that he did that were very well done. My narrator, producer Jeffrey Kafer, has been re-recording a lot of Nathan's stuff, and it's going back out again for the commercial market, and he's, you know, capitalizing on it over again.
Right. So there's a lot of things that came out of that crazy period, and you know, between 2007 and 2010, I guess was the high water mark.
Do you think ACX had anything to do with the decline, the sudden availability of people to do it for you and make a little money?
I'm not really sure if that was the moment that broke it. I think the ebooks, I think Kindle probably had more of an effect than Audible did or ACX did. But it's really difficult to say. It really is difficult to put your finger on the. It was difficult for me to put my finger on the point where it changed, but it did change, and you felt it. You just knew it because people stopped doing it. And I think part of that also, David, was the fact that we had so many new people coming in and doing it who pod faded. They would podcast 7 or 8 episodes of a book, and then they would never podcast again. And people were just stopped trusting the creators because the creators had given them all the reasons in the world to stop trusting them. So that's why I've gone now 2 or 3 years with an episode every week without missing a week.
That's amazing. Yeah, a couple of years ago I was listening to Ditch Diggers, which I've mentioned before, awesome mm-hmm. podcast with Matt Wallace and Merle Lafferty. And I don't know if maybe they were doing listener questions or something, but I remember that this very subject came up, and Matt said, well, I think Scott Sigler's still doing something, and I know Paul Cooley's still doing something, and that might be about it. I'm like, yeah, those might be the only people. And I don't think Scott's continuing new patio books. I'm not sure about that.
I think he is. He said he's basically going to podcast the first book in a series every time.
Okay, I think that's the new model. He's not doing all of them for free or something like that.
Right. Or they took down all the other books from the podcast.
Okay. So why do you still do it at a time that a lot of people have chosen to move along? What's in it for you?
Because I'm stupid. We know that. it's such a big part of my brand that abandoning it would be a nightmare. It would piss off a lot of my loyal readers. But here's the honest fact here, okay? I am spending the time to create the audiobook. I've already recorded it. Cutting it up and podcasting it is nothing compared to getting it recorded and mastered. So doing the podcast is almost an afterthought. It takes me maybe an hour a week to get 2 podcasts, one out for my Patreon patrons and one out for the general feed. It takes maybe an hour a week of work because I've already done all the hard stuff.
So in this case, you're just maximizing your revenue streams for a specific bit of content.
That is correct. So Derelict has been running for, holy crap, long freaking time now. We're 13 weeks away from the last episode of the second book. So I've got that long before I have to have the third book ready. But the third book will be more than ready by then. So it's one of these crazy things where I will have all the content recorded. So why don't I go ahead and put it in the podcast feed? And I get new listeners on a pretty regular basis.
And they buy books. Yeah. What's interesting to me is that you're established as someone who provides free audiobooks. You're offering, I think, an enhanced version as the podcast, like you add little bits and pieces and sound effects or something to slightly differentiate it from Audible?
Correct.
Okay. Yet you're still, you know, your most reliable income stream of your own stuff is your audiobook that's up for sale that people could listen to for free if they wanted to.
Correct.
Why do you think that is? Is it just certain audience segments like the convenience, whereas of, you know, tapping Audible and boom, there it is? Or is it something else? What do you think?
I think the whole idea of putting out a podcast novel is basically to make it so cool that by the fourth episode, they're going, God damn it, I have to get the book. I need to know what happens, and I can't wait another 26 weeks.
Okay.
And I think that's where people abandon the podcast and go to Audible and mainline it. And some of my audience, they listen to the podcast every week, even though they have already listened to the Audible version, because they want to listen to the version with all the sound effects and everything else. But they've already listened to the story once, and they'll come back and listen to it again with all the sound effects and all the crazy voices and everything else that goes on there. So, and the music. So
it's interesting. It sounds like a piece of audio content for you serves three purposes. It's a revenue generator from Audible. It's a revenue generator for Patreon. And then it's a tool for audience engagement and maybe promotion through the podcast.
Correct. All of those things kind of work together, and I'm still massaging how I do things and still trying to learn from, you know, looking at statistics and everything else, ways to improve, you know, all three channels and the way they intersect. It's an ongoing process. It's just a matter of, this is what I do now. If it ever gets to the point where it's a huge pain in the ass and absolutely getting in the way of writing, then I'm going to have to, you know, revisit it. I paid John Miro to narrate Closet Treats, which had already been out there with me, but it was poor mastering, and it was done when I didn't really know what I was doing. And I paid Veronica Jaguar to do one of the Garaga books because it would have been wrong for a male voice to try and do those stories.
Oh, we love your falsetto.
Oh, yes, of course. But at some point, like I'm going to have to record two audiobooks before the end of the year. I've got to get Gare's Inferno going, and as soon as I finish Destruction, and it goes Derelict Destruction, and it goes through its paces, I've got to record it too. That is a hell of an undertaking. It takes a long time to get that stuff done, and it's going to be. I'm not looking forward to it because it is a creative endeavor that is fraught with even more self-loathing than writing. Which is saying something. So it is one of those things, and I keep getting told again and again by folks, you know, Scott Sigler stopped narrating his own stuff for the most part. And I keep getting told at some point you're going to have to stop. And I'm just not there yet, but I know why that is. A lot of it is I'm a control freak about it. I know how it sounds in my head, and giving it to somebody else gives me the heebie-jeebies.
Well,
so,
also, you don't have the learning curve that someone who, let's say somebody was starting today and thought, maybe I'd like to narrate my own. There was so much you had to do over that six-month period, and I'm sure skills you've developed and things you've learned all along the way. Would you make the same choice, do you think, if you were starting today?
I think today it's a hell of a lot more difficult to find listeners. I think it's a hell of a lot more difficult because there is so much stuff out there. You know, there's things like Welcome to Night Vale. There's, The Black Tapes, which is really good. But those are audio dramas. You know, they're a different kind of story. And the audio dramas that are coming out from podcasts are still incredibly awesome, incredibly cool. But it's very difficult, I think, to find an audience these days if you're not doing collections or more eclectic stuff like Pseudopod, Castle Pod, or whatever they're calling it these days, Escape Pod. They do short stories. They do a short story every week, and they've been doing it for freaking 9, 11, 12 years, whatever. And they're still getting listeners, new listeners. Their listeners stick around all the time. And every week you can look forward to a short story. You may not enjoy it. It may not be the best one you've ever heard from week to week. That's obvious because the writers are all over the place and so are the narrators. But on average, they really pick good stuff. And so that's easier way to get in. If I don't like a book, if I get three episodes into Derelict and say this is crap, I'm going to check out of the podcast until Paul podcasts something else. It's very difficult to get new listeners to stick around if they don't, aren't in love with what you're doing, because you're only giving them 20, 25 minute slices of the story. And so there's a lot of things that go into it, but I think it's really a lot more difficult now with social media being the noise generator that it is now compared to what it was back in the old days. It's a lot more difficult to find an audience.
And, now with Netflix, we're cultivating the binge audience, where it used to be that serialization was the cool and fun thing. And now some people are wanting it all at once so they can do it when they want, watch it when they want to, consume it when they want to.
Yeah, and that's another part of the whole issue. Like I said, there are people who go to Audible and they'll purchase the book, but then they'll listen to the podcast. It is a weird, weird, weird thing. And I understand binging. That's why I go to Audible for a lot of these things as well, because I want to be able to listen to the audiobook from front to back without having to worry about this week I get, this 20-minute snippet that hits me on a cliffhanger. And I'm the guy who's known as a cliffhanger ambassador for what I do on my podcast. That has actually had a huge effect on the way I write, because I know when I need to leave a cliffhanger in a chapter before I start the next chapter.
You actually just answered my next question: was when you're writing, how does audio impact what you write?
Subconsciously, it's now just I know every 3,000 words I need to leave a chapter on a cliffhanger. I just know it. I know how long the average episode is for me, which is usually 2,500 to 3,500 words. And I know that means that the spacing has to be done in such a way where I leave the reader with a question or listener with a question. And you could throw in one of the old 30s serials deals, next time on so-and-so, we discover this, that, and the other. You can actually kind of do that and string people along, and it is a really horrible thing to do to them, and I love it.
Mm. The way audio impacts me when I'm writing is there will be times where I just stop and I look at a sentence and I look at the words I've chosen, and I'm just like, I can't ask Kafer to say that. I've accidentally written a tongue twister. Do you ever have that experience where you're like, okay, I can write this, but I'll never be able to narrate it?
There are times – well, my final editing pass before I put out a book that I try and do is I actually do the audiobook before we send it to press. And the reason is because when I'm reading it aloud, I will come across those awkward sentences. And I start looking at them and I go, I need to rewrite that because I cannot freaking pronounce it. And if I cannot speak that cogently, chances are it's not going to read very cogently either. So I try and go back and correct those things when I come across them, because I don't find them until I actually narrate the book.
And it seems like it's a good way to develop your skills with dialogue, because when you're saying it out loud and then listening to it back, if it sounds stiff or stilted or inauthentic, you're going to hear it.
Yeah, absolutely. It has a huge impact on how you write dialogue, because once these things have to be spoken aloud, you see where the pauses are and you see where it runs on and nobody's taking a breath and maybe it just turns into an info dump. And it's much more difficult to see that on the page. It's easier to hear it.
So moving on, we talked about how the podcast is a great way to connect with readers. How else do you as an indie either cultivate relationships with readers, or just how do you reach them in a crowded, noisy marketplace?
Oh, that one's tough, because I'm not even sure I'm doing it right. I interact with them on social media as much as possible. I have a Facebook author page. I've got, I don't know, 500 people on there, and Facebook's always bugging me about putting ads up there. But I will put up interesting science articles that relate to whatever work I'm putting out at that particular time. Like, for instance, if you go to my author page, right now you'll see a whole bunch of sciencey stuff about the New Horizons spacecraft discoveries, all these things about Saturn, Pluto, moons, Neptune. Any new information that come about that I can verify with a couple different sources, I will go ahead and put articles up there about it. And sometimes that kicks off people going, oh, you know how you could work this into your book? Like, yeah, I've already figured that out. And it's a lot of fun to see how they go with that. But then they can make all these jokes or comments or whatever else, and we just kind of have a good time with that. And by trying to find articles that kind of fit with what I'm writing at the time, it means basically, hey, this is stuff that I think is relevant to what you're reading right now. And that seems to work. It seems to bring people in, and I don't spam them. So I only put an article or two up there a week, usually, beside the link to the latest podcast episode. But it seems to be working just fine because people like to go there because they like to see what I'm going to post next.
All right. Well, we're coming down near the end, and one of the things I'll ask for everybody to do is give some of your best advice to a fellow indie author. And it's up to you whether it's somebody who's just starting out, somebody who maybe isn't at the level they want to be. It can be pub, it can be business, it can be craft. Give us some advice to indies.
Right.
Give us some more.
Wow, this is so funny because we just did a Dev Robot Society episode. Yeah. I think the big thing is to just keep going. It takes a long time. You have to be persistent unless you get really lucky or really know what you're doing. It takes a long time. It took me 7 years of working really, really hard on the podcast and everything else before the Black got published and suddenly I was a quote-unquote overnight success. And that means you spend a lot of time going through things. You spend a lot of time growing. You spend a lot of time evolving. And, I think the only ways you can get better besides just writing is reading what's out there, reading what people are doing, and pay attention to how they're doing it. So that means if you're going to be an indie, you pay attention to the cover designs that are out there for books that are selling well. You take a look at how they're being marketed, what the back cover blurb looks like, and try and ape that as much as possible, those kind of formats. Just basically go and see what these folks are doing. Pay attention to it. That doesn't mean you're writing to the market. It means you're marketing to the market. The writing can be completely different than you don't have to write to the market, but you do have to have some savvy when it comes to the things that that marketing successful books does. And I think the best way to learn that is actually go look at the covers in the genre, go look at how they're presented, and then put your own spin on it.
All right. Well, as we wrap it up, how about letting everybody know where they can find you online?
The best place to find me is shadowpublications.com, Parsec Award-winning shadowpublications.com.
Hosted by Parsec Award-winning douchebag.
Yeah, hosted by a Parsec Award-winning douchebag. That would be me. You can find all of my titles up there for free in podcast form. Of course, now you could mainline them because they're pretty much all done except for Derelict. You can also find my author page on Amazon.com under Paul E. Cooley. And I'm also the co-host of the Dev Robot Society writing podcast. So you can go to DevRobotSociety.com or catch our YouTube, youtube.com/DRS podcast, or look for us on iTunes or whatever else, and come join our community.
All right. Is it true that the E stands for Elvis?
No, it is not true.
Oh, damn. Okay. Well, that was my last question. Paul, thank you very much for being with us. Everybody check out his website, his free audio stuff, and the Derelict Saga. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David. Enjoyed it.